The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. So we will break in to the meeting and actually officially call it to order at that point. Today is Greg David's day at the Capitol, or as Dr. Rubis would say, that's every day at the Capitol. Somebody asked me what kind of a doctor is Mr. Rubis, and he's a doctor of taxology. So that's he's got a degree hanging on his wall. Okay, with that being said, we will get right into the bill. Do we have Mr. Representative Anderson, Chairman Anderson here? We're very fortunate today to have Chairman Paul Anderson with us, and I will move when we have a quorum, House File 3569. Members, if you take that out of your packets, please. And I do not see any amendments. Is that correct, Chair Anderson?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, please present your bill to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And this is a topic I'm sure you've already talked about some, but it deals with Section 179 expensing. And I'm sure you've discussed the ramifications of the new federal tax bill, but I'm here today to talk about as it may affect agriculture and farmers because of the change in how the feds are going to interpret the trade-in value of machinery that a farmer may possibly trade in the course of his doing business in the year. In the past, if a farmer had a combine that was worth $50,000, he trades that in on a new machine. It just goes off the boot price, and we go ahead from there. But with the change this year, my tax advisor told me that that $50,000 piece of equipment I trade in now becomes income beginning in 2018. And that's a cause for concern for many in agriculture. They may be having to claim income on this trade-in piece of equipment when, in fact, they had little or no income to show for the year. So what the bill does, Mr. Chairman, is allow for full 179 expensing on state returns. I know it's an extremely expensive ask, but I think because of the change in how trade-in values are going to be interpreted on the federal side, we need to make some kind of movement to a higher fast depreciation. And what my bill does is it limits it to farm machinery, that which is exempt from sales tax as a definition in the bill that we have here today. But that is the bill in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman, and I'd stand for questions, and I believe there's a couple of testifiers as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Anderson, Chair Anderson. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order, as we do have a quorum. I will move House File 3569. There are no amendments. Just for a show of hands, how many people would like to testify on behalf of the bill, Mr. Peterson, with concerns? Does the department wish to testify on this?
Not at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, let's bring your first witness down, if that's okay.
Sure.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we do support House File 3569. I'll be brief because I did testify in support of this concept earlier when you had like general comments on tax conformity, and visited with a lot of members that raising the Section 179 is a priority and has been a priority for a long time. It's something we hear a lot about from farmers just in general, and always having to keep two sets of books. You're probably familiar that the federal government had been at even a $500,000 or is right now and going to the $1 million. And so very difficult sometimes for farmers and does end up costing them for those that want to use the accelerated depreciation. And so this does help in those situations. And as Representative Anderson mentioned, and I testified to the committee before in raising some concerns, we too have heard from accountants that on the income piece, that could be very difficult for farmers, and they'd want to be able to duck that back out. And so with equipment also, I think we've been at $25,000 for a very long time, and I should have brought a copy of Tractor House. Just I think a lot of the committee is familiar with a lot of the pieces of equipment and what they cost, but that's very expensive. And so I appreciate your consideration. I know it's an expensive piece, but we would urge you to even look at raising it at some point, you know, or some level. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much. I think this is pretty straightforward. I think unless there's questions from members. Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I have to tell you, I have a group of farmers from Clay and Norman County visiting today. If you just raise your hands there. And we were talking taxes, and besides property taxes, the Section 179 is number one. And I also got a good kind of history talking about the $25,002 and how low that is. So if my understanding is correct, then you're conforming with federal law. So it would be going up to $1 million from the $25,000 and then with a phase-out period after $2 million? Or how does that? Just a question on that and then a few more comments.
Mr. Chair and Representative Marquardt, yes, that's correct. It would fully conform to the federal tax code. Yes.
Chair Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, you know, I've always thought this is a top priority for us because, you know, you're going to have some one-time dollars that's going to come through the deemed repatriation, and you don't want to use kind of those one-time dollars for ongoing obligations. And this kind of fits in to that because it's kind of a timing thing and so forth. So, so I think this is great. It's the way to go. And one question, maybe this is for Mr. Michael, is I've seen this must be more narrowly focused because I've seen dollar amounts like $85 million in a year where this is, I shouldn't say just, but like $18 million. So where's the difference there? Is this more narrowly defined or how does that go?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Marquardt, the difference between the other numbers that you have gotten is for full conformity on all Section 179. Representative Anderson's bill does it only for farm machinery, and so that's why it's a much smaller amount. So in the context of an overall conformity bill, where his bill does not have any of the base expansions that you would get in conformity that would pay for this, but in the context of a larger bill, you know, then you would have revenue that you could use potentially to offset the higher cost.
Chair Marquardt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Michael. And so, no, this is the way to go. And, you know, when we're in a time where you know, you've got kind of rising property taxes and, you know, we're working on some of those bills, but also low commodity prices, this is the time to do this. And so thank you, Representative Anderson, for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and maybe this is for Mr. Michael as well. The way I read this bill, this is for all expensing prior to December 31st of last year and is silent on any expensing going forward. Is that correct?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, it's the exact mirror opposite of that. It applies for property purchased in tax year 18 and following, and it would not affect the tax year 17 and previous. So it's essentially it conforms to the new federal rules on a going forward basis.
Short term, Peter, you are absolutely and completely wrong.
And that's not the first time, Mr. Chair. It'll happen.
Representative Petersburg, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you. I was just looking under line 2.27 and 3.6 where it says it does not apply for those, and so that is just referencing to the 80% figure, I'm assuming that. Okay, that's
Mr.
Part
Michael.
Of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, that's correct. Basically, the way you conform is by not applying the add back.
You're absolutely correct on that.
Thank you. One for two is good.
That's not bad. I wish I had that ratio. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, you know, we're going to have to deal with a lot of different options as we look at our opportunities ahead. And I would really be interested in us getting some analysis, if we could, on, you know, if this applied broadly to all types of businesses, or businesses broken down by a certain size, and whether or not, you know, and what the cost is of going up to from 25,000 to a million separate from the phase out. Because I think we have a couple different things going on in this bill. And no offense to you, Representative Anderson, I just think we all just need to kind of understand, you know, what does it mean to take out the phase out for certain types of businesses, for all businesses? What does it mean to increase to different amounts of equipment? Because obviously the majority of our businesses are not equipment based heavily, but some are. And, you know, should we be targeting in a broader way, depending on what the price is?
Thank you, Mr. Lawler. We'll go to the, and members can have more questions here on this bill, but we'll go to another testifier here. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Kaduna. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just wanted to speak actually to say how we could make this bill better. So we're certainly in support of doing this full conformity on Section 179 for farmers, but we also think you also need to do full conformities for small business as well. So that was what Representative Marquardt was mentioning with the larger revenue estimate. Obviously, this really has the same comments that were mentioned by Mr. Peterson, which is this really is targeted at small businesses and farmers to encourage them to invest in their operations by lowering the cost of capital. It's really a timing issue, the ability to depreciate in the year of purchase versus over numerous years. But for businesses, especially smaller, it really is a cash flow issue. So it does encourage them to invest more in their operations and allow them to write that off in the year of purchase. One thing to note is it's important when we're looking at federal conformity to not only just to adopt those provisions that are broadening the federal taxable income base, but also to adopt those provisions that are doing a tax benefit to really encourage the investment and growth in Minnesota as well. Most states do fully conform with Section 179. As you know, Minnesota does not fully conform, but requires businesses, including farmers, to add that back, raising their taxable income in Minnesota as compared to the federal. So as you move forward, we would encourage full conformity for all, both farmers and small business. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kaduna. Questions from members for Ms. Kaduna? I mean, you can see the potential here to really mess some people up if we don't fix this.
Yeah.
Questions for the author? If now you'd like to wrap it up, Chair Anderson.
Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair. Again, the need is there. As Representative Marquardt mentioned, farm incomes right now are in a historically low period. And if you have to pay income tax on a trade-in value, for example, and have no income to do it, it's a bit frustrating. So thanks for hearing the bill, and I would encourage members to give it some great thought. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I'll renew my motion that House File 3569 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, sir. Item next is, we'll wait for you. Okay, I will move House File 3464, and I do not have an amendment here. We have some folks. Is there anyone like to testify on this bill on behalf of it? Come on, it's my bill. Oh, we do. Okay. Scared me there. Okay, what I'd like to do, first of all, is there anyone else who would like to testify on behalf of this bill? Anyone with concerns? Would the department like to comment?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And there's a reason why these cookies are staying here, because they're actually brought by Mr. Cummings, and they smell so good, so they're going to sit here for a while. And then we'll go to the senior member of the committee first to pick his. And it'll go very good with my Maxwell House coffee. I just read on the box there, it's good to the last
drop.
Good to the last drop. And you know the history on that? I'll tell you where that came from. It's quite interesting, actually. Okay, let's see here. So I'll move House File 3464. I'm going to go to Mr. Williams to explain what my bill does.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, so Minnesota law currently allows individual income tax subtraction for individuals who claim the federal standard deduction. They can subtract 50% of their charitable contributions in excess of $500. The bill would expand that subtraction by allowing taxpayers to deduct the full amount of their charitable contributions if they claim the federal standard deduction. There's a small interaction with the new Federal Tax Cuts and Job Act, because the Department of Revenue estimates that the number of people claiming the federal standard deduction will increase as a result of the new federal law, and as a result of that, there's more people claiming this subtraction.
Okay. Thank you. So we'll go to testimony here, but first of all, Representative Schultz moves the minutes of Tuesday, March 13th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. You know, I feel, you know, I was raised Methodist, so I feel guilt and making a comment to Mr. Petersburg that was saying that he was absolutely wrong. I just got to thinking that if you were playing baseball and you were right once and wrong once, you'd be batting 500 and you'd be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
That's what I say. Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Chair Davids and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Taylor Putz, and I am the public policy advocate at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, representing 2,100 of the state's nonprofit organizations.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3464, a bill that would strengthen Minnesota's charitable deduction. Before I begin, I'd like to thank Chair Davids for his leadership, as well as the many members who support this bill and those who have already signed on. I'd also like to draw your attention to the letters of support in your folders from the Minnesota Council of Churches, United Ways of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Minnesotans interact with nonprofit organizations in numerous ways throughout the course of their daily lives, and sometimes without even realizing it, whether it's attending a weekly church service, participating in a blood drive, or going to a local theater production. Nonprofits in communities throughout the state are bringing people together to build strong, thriving, and joyful communities through animal shelters, health clinics, food banks, and more. In order to carry out this vital work, the nonprofit sector relies on charitable giving to fuel their missions. So it was not surprising that after the federal tax plan passed in December, that we received messages from organizations across the state concerned about how the tax plan would impact charitable giving. As you know, the tax plan nearly doubled the standard deduction, which means two-thirds fewer Minnesotans will be itemizing their income tax returns. Fewer people itemizing means fewer people will have a federal tax incentive to donate to nonprofits. Tax incentives are an important factor in one's decision to donate and to donate what amount. For example, approximately 30% of donations come in during the last month of the year, which means donors are paying attention to the tax incentive. House File 3464 addresses the unintended consequences on charitable giving in Minnesota by strengthening the state's charitable deduction. Currently, the deduction, as previously explained, provides a 50% tax deduction for total charitable contributions over $500. Contributions to any 501c3 organization are eligible for the deduction, including all public charities, churches, and faith-based organizations. The bill would strengthen the deduction by removing the $500 threshold and the 50% limit so that all taxpayers would be encouraged to donate more. This change increases the state-level incentive for people to support nonprofits, especially for those who once itemized. The tax code reflects Minnesota's values, and by strengthening the deduction, Minnesota can continue to have a strong and thriving nonprofit sector that is a steady source of economic growth in every region of the state, as well as a key partner with government in delivering essential services. Members of the committee, I hope you will consider supporting this bill to encourage more giving by all Minnesotans. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'm excited to introduce Sarah Klein, the Executive Director of the Domestic Abuse Project, and Joan Namark, a leader in her church. Thank you.
Okay, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Yes, I'm Sarah Klein, Executive Director of Domestic Abuse Project.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Davids and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 3464. Domestic Abuse Project, or DAP, provides services to families affected by domestic violence. We serve men, women, and children. We serve over 3,000 clients annually, several traveling from as far as Duluth and Grand Rapids and even out of state. Approximately one-third of our $1.8 million budget comes from individual donors. And of those donations, 25% is generated at the end of the tax year. Every dollar counts. Our donors give because they care, and often more at the end of the tax year because of the tax incentive. We rely on those donations to provide families safety, security, and healing. And we're doing our part to end generational cycles of violence. If we did not have those dollars, we would have to eliminate services to children like Nolan, who was one of our children in our infant, our birth to three services. He came to us as a three-year-old and can act out scenes of violence that he remembered as an infant. Through this dyadic work, we are able to work with two generations simultaneously. It's innovative, research-based, and we are seeing it transform lives. Nolan is now 4 years old, and he is on a healing path. His mom feels affirmed in the behaviors that she saw in her child at an early age and now has the tools to help him continue to develop in a healthy way into adulthood. DAP's model is built on the concept of a coordinated community response. It takes all of us to come together to end violence. Our work requires us to partner with individuals, with government entities, and private corporations. We could not do our work without our key partners, and they would tell you the same. We're really here to support this bill. It's very important to our work and to the communities that we serve. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 3464.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Davids and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joan Namark, and I'm a lay leader.
Spell your last name.
N-A-Y-M-A-R-K.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm glad to be here. I'm a lay leader for social justice at First Universalist Church located in South Minneapolis, and for the record, I was also raised Methodist. On behalf of churches and religious organizations like ours, I strongly encourage you to support House File 3464 that strengthens our state's charitable deduction. Our church's mission is to give, receive, and grow in the spirit of love and hope. Like all religious organizations, we are positioned to nimbly fill gaps outside our church walls for immediate needs such as emergency food and shelter that government cannot quickly meet. We act to shape the larger community into a more just and equitable society by working with community partners. For example, our church members provide meals at Simpson Housing Services, build homes with Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, support low-income students at Augsburg Fairview Academy, prepare tax returns for low-income families with Emerge in North Minneapolis, and provide shelter for those experiencing homelessness through Beacon Interface Families Moving Forward. Our church building is a resource in the community for arts with the Exposed Brick Theater, education with the Southside Child Development Center located there, and social justice work in the community. We've launched a small business from our building, the Sous Chef, who is starting a restaurant and a cookbook. All of this critical work within and outside our church requires support from our 1,000 members through donations of all sizes. While church members give all year, our members receive a request for year-end donations from the church in the late fall to encourage their monetary support before the end of the year. December is our largest giving month, as we've heard before, reflecting the importance of the tax deduction. Like many churches, donations are used to sustain the ministry of our church and these community partners. We're proud that the majority of our offering plates year-round are shared with these community partners. Together, we give our energy, time, and money to the work of creating a better world and start close at home. On behalf of First Universalist Church, religious organizations, and community-based groups, we urge you to support strengthening the charitable deduction. This is a tool that will keep our churches and nonprofit organizations strong. Thank you so much for letting me testify.
Thank you, Ms. Namark, for your testimony. Members, I appreciate being able to, as we're hearing all these bills, we're hearing ideas. If you look at the revenue note on this one, it may be considered a bit aggressive, but I think we need to do something in this regard, and so I'll be working with Mr. Putz and others to see where we can end up on this one. If we can fit it in, I'd certainly like to. But questions for members for the three witnesses? Ms. Namark, Ms. Klein, or Mr. Putz. Okay, I think we understand this bill. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And the department was not in on this one, right, at this point? Okay, thank you. Okay. I will move House File 3464 be laid over for possible conclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next. 3, 4, 10, or 11. Okay. Okay. Members, I will move the Davids Marquardt bill, House File 3410. This is a department. Is this technical or policy? This is the policy or the department technical bill. And so we will have Mr. Cummings and others run through this for us. But before we do that, I feel like passing these out at the end, it just smells so good. But if a page could come forward, these are compliments of Mr. Cummings.
Not the department.
Not the department. This is Mr. Cummings. If I could get a page here, maybe. They just smell so good. He stayed up all night last night baking these, and so we're very happy with that. Start with the ranking member here, or the senior member.
Grab one for yourself.
Well, like I said, I like this seniority thing better every day. Okay, so with that, we should get these going around, too.
Well, that mind. Mr. Chairman, he knows the seniority. He goes to the second most senior member.
Right. He's going by the rules, but not just the right now. Thank you very much, Mr. Cummings. We should probably save one for Mr. Cummings, too.
No, Mr. Chair, it's not on the plan.
Okay. Okay, with that, Mr. Cummings, please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please, sir, and present your bill. My bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the 2018 Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. A special thank you to you, Mr. Chair, for carrying all of the policy and technical bill provisions. I also wanted to thank Representative Marquardt for helping us ensure that the bills were drafted with the reviser. During the period in which the department could not work with the reviser's office, Representative Marquardt worked to have the bills drafted. Specifically, Mr. Travis Reese was a critical go-between to ensure our bills were drafted using the reviser standards while meeting the dictates of the LCC resolution. So again, to Representative Marquardt and Mr. Reese, thank you. Mr. Chair, I will be providing some opening remarks, and then our attorneys will be walking through the provisions of the policy and technical bills. We have two bills this year, Mr. Chair.
What attorneys you got here?
We have a couple resources to ensure that your questions are answered, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, I don't know about you, but I am a big Minnesota State Fair fan. The excitement, the people, the numbers and types of food, the grandstand, the machinery, Machinery Hill, Milk Booth, seeing big-time celebrities like from KDWB and CCO, the Department of Revenue booth in the Education Building is, of course, my favorite. For those not acquainted...
Mr. Cummings, you need to get a life.
For those not acquainted, it can be awe-inspiring, confusing, frustrating, fun, and interesting. Nothing compares to the State Fair. It is the main attraction. I kind of feel that way about the federal tax bill conversation this year. It is certainly the main attraction. Yet even in the midst of our incomparable State Fair, there are unique and important county fairs that shouldn't be discounted and are part of the fabric of what it means to be a Minnesotan. This is where local Lions Club hosts bingo, Wally Pickle plays five trumpets at a time, 4-H is tending to the livestock and projects. Things get a little odorous sometimes in the animal buildings, but it's sure to be cleaned up quickly. A smaller show, but just as interesting. So today I ask that we take a little time away from the main attraction and focus on a smaller yet just as important part of the tax fabric of Minnesota, our policy and technical bill approaches.
Mr. Cummings, what is the largest county fair in Minnesota?
I think that is the Steele County Free Fair, maybe?
Yeah, I think Steele's next first, and then Olmsted a second, maybe, for county fairs. Steele has a huge one. Yeah. Please continue.
One of the strategies to achieve the department's vision, Mr. Chair, is that we are listening to our customers to identify and develop improvements to the revenue system. Throughout the year, the Department of Revenue notices items, many times after working with our customers in the tax code, that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. These ideas are developed, edited, and improved throughout the interim. After development, they are drafted into bills and begin to move through the legislative process. These bills make needed changes that help ensure our tax code is working properly. They improve the clarity and effectiveness of the tax code. Many people tend to view the provisions in these bills as either policy, having a substantive impact, or technical, conforming to current practice or a change with no impact. Yet many times it is not as black and white. It is usually grayscale, somewhere in between. In preparing these bills, we need to make judgment calls as to which bill it is most appropriate. if you would have selected another bill, placement, we're open to the discussion of which bill it should be in. But we prepared two bills rather than one in deference to the legislature's request. Mr. Chair and members, I would like to offer to you all of our assistance to ensure that we have an opportunity to address issues in an appropriate way if they are brought forward. These are small but important provisions that will make the tax code better. So if issues arise, we thank you preemptively for the opportunity to work with you and stakeholders. We have heard in the past that if something is controversial, it should be removed. Yet I would submit to this committee that what is being carried in this bill are items that the tax committee should care about to ensure that there is a fair and equitable resolution. We would ask for your continued commitment to working on these provisions to ensure we find the right approach for all Minnesotans. In fact, we are right in the middle of talking to people who have come forward with questions, concerns, or issues. We've already talked to Clearway Minnesota and the Minnesota High Tech Association. We plan to meet with the Minnesota Hospitality Association and resort owners on the resort homestead provisions and the local lodging tax. I think that's later today. We have a meeting with the Chamber and the Bar Association on the Qualified Data Center language and the partnership language. We've met on the partnership language a couple times before. We also heard from vape shop owners, the tobacco industry, and assessors about some ideas that they had as well. We are happy to meet with anyone who brings any ideas forward. We also were presented today with a letter from COST. We got a phone call from Oregon yesterday telling us how the Minnesota tax code should be changed. We are happy to meet with Minnesota practitioners about changes that need to be made, and we look forward to doing that, Mr. Chair. We look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, on incorporating the provisions today in the final bill, hopefully after some of them can be improved. We thank the I really wanted to take this time before I turn it over to Mr. Iden to thank our attorneys, our researchers, and staff within our divisions who have worked a very long time. The stewardship of our tax code is of very high value at the Department of Revenue, and so I hope that you can see that in this work they have made a good faith efforts at trying to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to turn it over to our attorneys within our department who will walk through the bills as a resource to this committee. I may chime in if there are questions or in response to member questions or to react to feedback. Again, thank you for the opportunity to present these bills today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And just to the lay of the land here, I have listed here as testifiers Cap O'Rourke, Beth Cadoon, Joel Larson, Joel Carlson, and that's who I have listed. And I have Mr. McElroy also. Is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns on this House File 3410? Okay, now I am not going to rush through this. I want to hear from the department. I want members to be able to ask questions. And we do have floor session at noon, so we will be adjourning for the day at about a quarter to or 22. I'm getting slower to get over there. So we will be doing that, but we're not going to rush these two through. We want to hear, and if we're done by then, that's fine. But if not, that's fine, too. We'll schedule later. So please state your name or chair.
Mr. Chair, does that mean you would like us to put our files back in the green?
We'll see where we're at. Yes, I would.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. We can save a few.
So if we finish this one but not the next one, we'll just keep going and have them done. Very, very good. Very good. Okay, so with that, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeremy Iden, and I am the individual income tax and withholding attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have the pleasure of presenting to you Article 1 of the technical bill in the Individual Income and Corporate Franchise Tax article. Section 1 of Article 1 amends 289A.38 to provide specifically that taxpayers are required to report changes to their returns following a settlement or compromise under the Internal Revenue Code Sections 7121 or 7122. Sections 2, 4, and 5 amend both the new Social Security subtraction and the rate brackets to provide specifically that the rate brackets should be split and then adjusted for inflation for the married filing separate. Currently under law, we adjust for inflation. I'm sorry, we split and then adjust for inflation, which can make the married filing separate $1 off from the married filing joint being half. This would change that to make sure that the married filing separate is exactly half of the married filing joint. Sections 3 and 4, last year the Minnesota legislature enacted 290.0137 requiring modified reporting for certain installment gain sales. This provision contained an addition paragraph and a subtraction paragraph and contained its own allocation paragraphs for non-residents. This change strikes the allocation provisions contained in 290.0137 and moves them into a non-resident fraction in sections 290.0062C, which is where the other allocation provisions for addition and subtraction modifications are contained. Section 6 modifies 290.92 subdivision 28 in regards to payments to horse racing license holders. There was a cross-reference in this subdivision that was moved in a prior session, and this just fixes that cross-reference. And Section 7 modifies the new first-time homebuyer program. This will allow taxpayers to specify their required designated beneficiary on their tax return instead of by April 15th. And that concludes Article 1.
Thank you. Questions for members on Article 1 to Mr. Iden? Thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask that Ms. Margaret Reisdorf could present Article 2 for us.
Ms. Reisdorf, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Reisdorf, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'll be summarizing Article 2, the sales tax section, that has five sections.
Welcome to the committee.
All right, starting on line 8.13, Section 1, this provision amends a sales tax exemption for materials and items used in ships conducting interstate commerce, and it corrects an ambiguity to ensure that all types of vessels are eligible for the exemption. The ambiguity was created due to the 2000 recodification. Section 2, this language codifies the department's consistent interpretation of current law and further provides further clarity to the department's longstanding administrative guidance by making two technical changes. The first change ensures that when the Department of Employment and Economic Development certifies a qualified data center, that they specify the date upon which qualification occurs. And what this does is it allows us to be sure that the exemption for electricity can be measured appropriately. The second change clarifies that when computer software in a data center that is stored, utilized, or loaded at the data center, that it will meet the criteria of being purchased for use in the qualified data center only if it operates, maintains, or monitors the enterprise information technology equipment, or manages, manipulates, analyzes, collects, stores, processes, or allows access to the data at the data center.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
On the data center provision, if I could just give a little background, if that would be helpful.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, in general, companies that build or refurbish data centers may qualify for a sales tax exemption for 20 years on enterprise information technology equipment, software, and electricity used to operate the data centers. So this exemption, Mr. Chair, as you know, from sales tax was first enacted in 2011. And in that time, with refunds being paid beginning after July 1st, 2013, it was estimated to cost approximately $24 million in 2014, and approximately $4 million in 2015. This exemption was substantially modified in 2013. Square footage and investment requirements were reduced, and the qualification period extended. At the time, the exemption changes to the changes to the exemption were estimated to cost approximately $8 million per year, per fiscal year. The most recent tax expenditure report anticipated that the qualified data center exemption would cost $70 million in fiscal year 2018. Based on the increase in filings, that figure could grow. One thing that we have identified is that the most recent claims in our inventory include a large portion for computer software. While the inclusion of software is not new, the amount has changed. In December 2017 alone, which is data that was not available for the purposes of the tax expenditure report. Refund claims exceeded $50 million. About 55% of those claims, or about $27 million, is attributable to computer software. Mr. Chair, I'm going to lay out some buckets for you of computer software. There are generally three types of software included in claims for refunds under this exemption. So software that, bucket one, I'd say, is software that operates, maintains, or monitors the enterprise information technology equipment located in a qualified data center. So this could be software that could turn on a cooling system. Bucket two, I would say, is software that manages, manipulates, analyzes, collects, stores, processes, distributes, or allows access to large amounts of data at the data center. And typically those would be maybe sort of an inventory management system of some kind. And then three, there is software with multiple licenses loaded at the data center, but really pushed out throughout the enterprise and used within various computers across an enterprise. So this is maybe updates to Microsoft software or word processing on your work computer. So the department's current position under current law is that the latter category, the updates for the software that, you know, may have a license at a computer, does not qualify for the exemption. So those claims are being denied at this time. This aligns with the statutory language as well as with testimony provided by the bill author in 2013, who testified that the bill would not provide a continual exemption for computer software. The author explained that what we are trying to define here is not an exemption for typical software that you'd see at the Capitol. Rather, the exemption is only software specific to data centers and their operations. So even so, the sales tax exclusion for software within the first two categories is significant. The first two buckets is about 55% of all claims on inventory today. Only 1% of the current claims are attributable to the third category of software, the multiple license updates that are loaded at the data center and pushed out. So this technical proposal was intended to make clear that only software that operates the technology equipment at the data center or manages large amounts of data at the data center qualifies. Some may testify today that this provision is removing software from the exemption, and that is not the proposal, to be very clear. This technical proposal deals with the 1% of claims that is currently being denied, not the over 50% of claims that come in from software. It may benefit, may be a benefit to this committee to take a deeper look at software in general and the data center exemption, the large growth in this exemption, and whether it is appropriate that this be made smaller. But again, that would be a larger discussion that would deal with the fiscal proposal. This is only a clarification of law, not a large policy change.
Mr. Cummings, this is, you're talking about the 1%?
The 1% of claims, Mr. Chair, not...
We're going after the 1%ers again? This is supposed to be a technical bill.
Mr. Chair, as you'll hear, the of income taxes, it is top 2%.
Oh, okay. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Mr. Cummings, and this is maybe for you, Mr. Chair. I don't remember us having a conversation about kind of parsing this out. Did we say in tax committee that this was kind of, we wanted it only for these specific purposes? Or can you help remind me?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Anderson. This was in 2011, as Mr. Cummings said. That was in the smoking hot tax bill, the original data center language.
Mr. Chair, so the conversation that I'm referencing was in 2013.
Okay, so what, Mr. Cummings, what was done in 2013?
In 2013, square footage and investment requirements were reduced, and then the qualification period was extended. The changes to the exemption then were approximately to cost about $8 million.
But, Mr. Cummings, that didn't affect software. Did it?
I'll turn it over to Ms. Reisdorf.
To the Anderson question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, in 2013 there were changes to the specifications of the definition of what would constitute a qualified or a qualified refurbished data center. Like Mr. Cummings mentioned, the square footage and the investments amounts were reduced and the time period was extended. And then in addition to that, there was a definition for computer software added.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm going to look at that further because the smoking hot tax bill established the data center issue, and then the cold as ice tax bill made those changes. Okay, we'll dig into that further. Chair Anderson? Okay, but I do. We are going to be digging into that further because there's a lot of questions about
that. We appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Thank
we
you.
Certainly do.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, what do the folks from Oregon want?
Mr. Chair, they expressed general concerns, and I asked them to call back our attorney to talk about through some of the specific concerns that they might have. I know that we had met again with practitioners from Minnesota, and we look forward to working with them.
About what? Concerns about what?
There's some partnership language within our policy bill. The Trump administration promulgated some regulations in December of 2017, and so this is trying to ensure that for adjustments made by the IRS that we can be able to process those returns at the state level.
Did they express that concern to 48 other states?
Mr. Chair, there are, cost can speak for itself. I think that they are trying to manage a process with interested parties and how to respond to these changes in every state. I think that we are very involved with the interested parties model to ensure that we're really trying to use as much as we can from the interested parties model based on the statutes that we have in Minnesota. But I also think that there is a general sense that they don't want to move forward with any legislation in the statewide level. But again, these are what you'll hear, Mr. Chair, is that these are federal adjustments for things that are happening. So we there is a level of conformity that needs to happen. If it doesn't happen this year, we'll have to see a retroactive change so that if there are large federal adjustments that Minnesota can ensure that taxpayers are being treated equitably regardless of how the federal government acts on their return.
Okay. Chair Anderson, we finished on the data center. Okay, and we will be digging into that deeper because I need to be refreshed on that. Okay. Ms. Reisdorf.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so I'm resuming Section 3, starting on page 11.29. So both Sections 3 and 4 deal with deed certification for two different exemptions. It's just clarifications to make clear that the Department of Employment and Economic Development is responsible for certifying qualification for these exemptions. And then finally, Section 5. Section 5 amends Minnesota Statutes 297A.77 by adding a subdivision to reinsert a sentence that had been inadvertently omitted from 1989 Minnesota Statutes 297A.27 subdivision 3 during the 289A recodification in 1990. And that concludes Section 2.
Thank you very much. Questions for Ms. Reisdorf? Thank you very much. Or was there? Oh, I'm sorry. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, so is Section 4, is that dealing with the pharmaceutical company up in Brooklyn Park?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes.
Chair Anderson? Okay. Other questions? Okay, let's go to the next testifier, please. Please state your name and who you represent for the record. Please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll go through a section dealing with tobacco taxes. These are three changes that are related to the definition of vapor products. Some taxpayers, which we believe has been within the definition of a tobacco product since the 2010 law change, some taxpayers have disagreed with us recently on our position that vapor products and e-cigarettes are subject to tax. Like I said, we disagree, but we decided to come forth with this legislation to make it as clear as possible. So Section 1 simply makes it clear that vapor products are tobacco products. Section 2 creates a definition of vapor products that is consistent with current law, its current department practice, and is similar to the definition that has been included in several bills that have been introduced in the Minnesota legislature the last 3 or 4 years. Now, this definition includes a number of things that we don't ordinarily tax, such as pipes, heating elements, and those kinds of accessories. But that's also part of the current definition. But we don't tax that now. And the reason we don't is because we issued a revenue notice in 2012 that says that if elements of a package, like a pipe with a cartridges that you can put in there, if those cartridges of nicotine are sold separately and are available separately in the market, that we only impose the excise tax on the value of those cartridges. And the change in Section 3 to the wholesale sale price is meant to codify the position we took in that revenue notice. Now, there's one other thing that's going on here. The department has always known that nicotine could be produced from something other than tobacco. However, we always thought and were told that it was not economically viable to actually extract nicotine from any other plants. However, recently there have been some people who have been able to produce it in a laboratory. So there's some manufactured nicotine that is starting to appear in the markets. I'm not sure if it's in the Minnesota market or not. There is no chemical distinction between nicotine produced in the lab and nicotine produced from tobacco. The Department of Revenue certainly can't determine that. So the definition of vapor product will also include nicotine produced from something other than a tobacco product.
What else are they making it out of?
Mr. Chair, I don't know. I mean, it's some sort of patented in the lab mixing up of chemicals. I do not know.
Well, I thought you said it was from another plant.
No. I mean, I think it is, Mr. Chair. I think you can do it out of other plants, but I don't think that's what's happening in the lab.
Oh, okay. Please continue.
That's
it?
All, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Questions from members? Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, we have heard some feedback, and maybe I'll be open with you about some of the feedback that we've heard. We've heard from some of the tobacco companies that they would like to see a larger discussion related to vapor products so that there is some parity between open systems and closed systems, sort of the juice people and then the sort of product and the pods people.
I actually understand what you're saying.
You do. We've been there.
I know way too much about vaping.
And I think, Mr. Chair, our response to that conversation is we wholeheartedly agree that we should provide a way to have parity in this area. And but at the very least, Mr. Chair, at the end of last session, that was not an element that was ready to be in the final bill or ready to find a way to move forward. Hopefully we can find that path by the end of this session. These are some technical updates that we wanted to ensure pass that provide clarity. So even if there isn't a larger solution on vapor, which we'd like to continue to work with you on, these are smaller, more technical in nature.
Mr. Cummings, I think getting agreement on conformity will be much easier than this. But we'll work on it.
We're here to help.
Yes, as a resource. Okay, any other questions for Mr. Peterson? If not, we'll go to the next testifier. Please, thank you, Mr. Peterson. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be walking you through the remaining provisions of the technical bill today, beginning with Article 4. Section 1 clarifies the Commissioner of Revenue may collect property tax data at the parcel level or in the aggregate at the time and in the form and manner specified by the Commissioner. This language amends statute to reflect the Property Record Information System of Minnesota, commonly referred to as PRISM, which is the Department's current system for collecting property tax data. Sections 2 through 9, 12, and 14 through 21 strike references to abstract level reports, as this is no longer the format in which the Department receives property tax data. In the same vein, Section 22 repeals Minnesota Statute Section 275.29, which describes the abstract of tax list, as this is no longer accurately describes the form in which the Department receives the described data. Section 10 clarifies that in order to be classified as 1C property, the owner of the homestead and resort property must be the same. This language is consistent with how the Department interprets current law and provides further clarity to the Department's longstanding administrative guidance. Section 11 clarifies the calculation of the homestead market value exclusion in cases of a fractional homestead. This language is amended to mirror that of the proration language enacted last year for the agricultural homestead market value credit. Section 13 clarifies that a fractional agricultural homestead will receive a fractional maximum agricultural homestead market value credit amount. And Mr. Chair, this concludes Article 4.
Thank you. Questions? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can the department give me greater clarification of why they're looking to get the property tax data down to the parcel level and what uses you would have for the data, what you intend to do with it?
Ms. Griffin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, when we have a property tax data at the parcel level, we are able to get to more accurately calculate local government aid, get more accurate revenue analyses when it comes to bills that are being heard with the property tax system. We can analyze how changes would affect the property tax system. So it really just allows us to look at the property tax system at a more granular level and identify patterns in how counties are administering the system.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would this then, I assume, would impact the aid that we do to communities, wouldn't it?
Ms. Griffin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we would use that granular data in order to calculate the local government aids, correct?
Chair Anderson.
Mr. Chair, so is, and I forgot your name, I apologize.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, it's Chelsea Griffin.
Ms. Griffin, so is there a cost projection on this? If you're getting greater data, I imagine that there is probably some money behind that as well.
Mr.
And how
Chair,
that will change for each of the areas as well. I think that they're...
Sure.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, most of the local units of government are already submitting the data at parcel level. So this is something that we're already receiving as part of the PRISM project and is already being mostly incorporated into the work on the types of analyses that we're doing. So it is just a technical update to ensure that our statutes are reflecting what we're currently asking for.
Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings, what communities don't provide the information?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think I don't know the answer to that question. I think there may be one county in which we're still working with, but I can get back to you on that.
Chair Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, I think I would like to visit with you more on that.
Sure.
Thanks.
Okay. And Article 4, of course, Chair Drazkowski and his committee will certainly want to be reviewing that.
Mr. Chair.
Well, sir, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I just wanted to take a moment to talk about both Article 10, 11, and 13.
Certainly.
For the resort clarification, Mr. Chair, the department has consistently interpreted current law, which is Minnesota Statutes 273.13, Subdivision 22, to require common ownership of a homestead and resort for property to qualify as 1C homestead, formally referred to as Ma and Pa resorts. This statute allows commercial seasonal resort property to qualify as a homestead property so long as the property includes a dwelling that is used as a homestead by the owner, including by a shareholder partner member of a corporation partnership LLC that owns the resort. We have long provided administrative guidance to counties as to our interpretation that the ownership of the homestead and resort must be the same, and it is our understanding that counties have generally been applying this interpretation. The 1C classification already creates an exemption to general homestead requirements by allowing entity-owned commercial property to be a homestead. Our guidance requiring common ownership of a resort and homestead ensures that the homesteading owner lives on the resort, not on property neighboring the resort. Mr. Chair, this is a property tax reduction that for many people could be significant. And so ensuring that we have some clarity and consistency and an appropriate standard is important. Now, some may talk about a tax court case that had come up related to this, WBR Inc. versus Crow Wing County. The tax courts, there was a decision about this that may be referenced. Their 2013 decision involving the statute involved a situation where resort property was divided into separate 1A residential homestead and 4C seasonal commercial non-homestead parcels. In the end, the court rejected the county's argument that this division of the property resulted in the homestead dwelling no longer being on the resort property and instead was adjacent to the property. So there were two different ownership structures, and then the court said that it should be classified under the Monpa Resort classification. Now, the tax court reasoned that because the resort included the homestead dwelling prior to the current owner's purchase, that dwelling remained part of the resort. So the county didn't appeal the tax court's decision. Now, in this case, to create a larger policy, we never want to sort of criticize anything that the tax court did, and it may be appropriate in this case, but to create a larger policy that our property tax classifications should not be based on current ownership, but should be based on prior ownership arrangements or how something was previously used, is a policy that we don't think creates an appropriate policy for everything across the state. And so we continue to use our current interpretation that we've been using on this. As I said in my introduction, Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with the Hospitality Association and the resort owners to continue to think about this, to talk about ownership situations and how this works in many situations. On the last...
To that point, Mr. Cummings,
yeah.
Just looking through this quickly, I just want to make sure there's no changes to the 4C classifications for southeastern Minnesota on a former rail bed, on a river, on a Tuesday?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Are we doing anything with that?
Mr. Chair, we have not. We're at 1C right now, and so maybe 2, 3, 4, you know, it's a few years away.
That would be controversial. I worked very hard on that one. Yeah.
So that would be in the policy.
Continue, sir.
Finally, Mr. Chair, Sections 11 and 13 deals with just really trying to update some language that was passed last year. The language in this bill is a technical update to what was passed last year for fractional agricultural homesteads and the market value credit. And so I think that you may hear some feedback, maybe not today but later on, that people don't like how these the market value homestead credit is apportioned or fractioned out to many of the different types of owners. But this isn't this proposal. This proposal is cleaning up some other language. They're talking about a larger policy issue on how homesteads are divided in areas in which there's multiple owners. So in either case, we want to ensure that this language is cleaned up or a new policy is set.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Questions for members for Mr. Cummings or Ms. Griffin? Okay, with that, I believe we'll go to testimony. I have a list here.
Mr. Chair, we have Article 5.
Miscellaneous,
yes.
Oh, that's pretty important. Who has that? Ms. Griffin? Awesome.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
yeah, let's go.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, Sections 1 through 28 of Article 5 contemporize references to blind, disabled, and married populations throughout the tax chapters of the Minnesota statutes. There are no tax changes that occur for these populations as a result of the amendments in these sections. And finally, Section 29 updates a change to the tax court statute made last year to now provide that all cases have 30 days to file post-trial motions. Mr. Chair, this concludes Article 5.
Questions from members on Article 5? Okay, thank you very much. With that, Mr. Cummings, you want to wrap it up at all here?
Mr. Chair, we look forward to working with you and stakeholders on creating a great policy and technical bill set. We look forward to coming back and talking about our policy bill.
Fine legislation. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, we will go to Mr. Cap O'Rourke, Strategic Consulting. If you'd please join us, and then why don't we get like three folks down here, like Beth Cadoon, also, and Jill Larson. They won't be on, right? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I am here today on behalf of the Independent Vapor Retailers of Minnesota. We are just here to express a little bit of concern with some of the department's technical changes to how they are classifying vapor products. We understand that the goal is to codify what their interpretations have been while we are largely we support getting greater clarity on what the department's interpretations have been. We're not sure that the current language quite hits the mark, and we will be working with the agency to try to clarify, get better language as we move forward. So
now, Mr. O'Rourke, I want to make it clear, I had no part in this part of the technical bill, just for the record. Not yet.
Mr. Chairman, that has been duly noted, despite the fact that this is your bill.
Details.
Details. Yep, yep. Yeah. No, but I understand, and
I think Mr. Cummings gave Mark Court and Mr. Reese quite a bit of credit for this bill. Okay. Any questions for Mr. O'Rourke? There's a lot of history here, folks, in case you're wondering. And all good, all good. So questions? Okay, let's go then to, thank you, Mr. O'Rourke, and we will work with you on this. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to speak about the issue I've already talked a little bit about, which is in Article 2, Section 2 on the qualified data centers.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I first want to give a little bit of historical perspective and the purpose of the bill, which I think helps explain our concerns with the language. As was mentioned, I'll start with the good news, which is this was provision was brought forth in 2011 in the tax bill authored by Chair Davids. And the purpose was to attract data centers. And the good news is this is truly working. And I think this gets to the revenue estimate, the cost that was mentioned, which is greatly exceeding projections on the amount of the number of data centers being built in Minnesota. So I think that's why you were seeing the revenue estimates that Mr. Cummings was mentioned being a bit off on that. I think the original 2011 proposal mentioned there was 18 projects that were being looked at by BEAD at that point. Right now we have 33 qualified data centers that I'm aware of. And this was also highlighted in a recent article that I saw, which is why Minnesota is an emerging data center market to watch. And a lot of that is because of these tax provisions that are encouraging that investment to occur in the state. As was mentioned, businesses have to commit to a large investment of over $30 million in the first 4 years. And then they get certified big deed. They then invest in the operations, and then they apply for refund. And so this provision here, we do not believe is really making technical changes. We do believe it is changing the current law to greatly narrow what is being this computer software that will have the sales tax exemption. And so our concern is if DOR limits the software refunds as it is proposing, this will create an unfavorable tax situation in Minnesota compared to these other states where most or all of software purchases are exempt. This is a very competitive area for investment by other states, and we want to make sure that we're not too narrowly constraining it in order to, that will actually undermine the ability for Minnesota to get those operations in the state. We will we're meeting with Department of Revenue to discuss this language in more detail to make sure that it is more narrowly crafted. We do not believe the current language does that and will be too restrictive. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. This is interesting because the 2011 provision has just been so much more successful than we could ever have imagined, which is a good thing. But I can see where the department has some thoughts and concerns, so we'll need to work through these as we move forward here. Questions for Ms. Cadoon from the chamber? Chair Mark.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadoon, and maybe we're not talking the same thing, but you mentioned that kind of, as Mr. Cummings explained, three kind of buckets. And you mentioned that this would impact all software sales. Are you referring to the third bucket or other things? Because Mr. Cummings' testimony was that this represented 1% of the claims, kind of this third bucket. So just kind of an understanding there.
Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Marquardt, we think the language as currently drafted by the Department of Revenue does not provide probably the clarity that they are suggesting, and we think that it's probably a little too broad and confusing yet, and so it does need to be more narrowly crafted to make sure it's getting at that third bucket that they mentioned.
Okay. Very good.
Chair Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So it sounds like then you would support, if it was narrowed down to these 1% of the claims, that would be okay? I mean, I'm just trying to get some clarification.
Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, so that would be part of our conversation that we'll be having with the department on Monday with some of the folks that actually have been certified data centers to make sure that is their understanding of the investment when they went into it. But we think we can get to that point of more narrowly crafting it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. Other questions for members for Ms. Kadun? Okay, we'll then go to Ms. Larson. We're very fortunate to have you with the committee today, at the committee today, and then I believe I have Joel Carlson and Mr. McElroy. So why don't you both come down here, if you would. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Jill Larson, the Minnesota Business Partnership. I will just make a couple of comments because I'm here to testify also on Article 2, Section 2, regarding the sales tax exemption for the qualified data centers. As was mentioned, we believe this is clearly not a technical change. We actually think it's a fairly substantial policy change and not consistent with what was the legislature's intent when the law was first passed or when it was amended in 2013. It appears to our members that when after the law was first passed, the department was approving a lot of these claims. And then since then, they have not approved claims for the exact same issue. And so it appears that the department is continuing to change their interpretation and narrow and narrow and narrow it, which we believe is not consistent with the plain language of the law. So like Ms. Kadu mentioned, we will be meeting with the department on Monday to try to work through some of these issues, but wanted to bring to the committee's attention that this is, from our members' perspective, very concerning. A lot of companies made large investments in Minnesota based on the current law feel that this is sort of now kind of backing out on what the agreement was when the law was passed. And my understanding, Mr. Chairman, is there are proposals or potential new data centers in the queue right now that are counting on the way the law is written, and that those are in jeopardy if this language were to be adopted. Okay. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Larson? You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, we always hear people say that, you know, Minnesota's tax structure is too high, which it is, and so companies don't come here. But in 2011, the reason they love Minnesota so much for data centers is because they create so much heat and it's cold here. So you can just open the window, right?
That's not exactly true, Mr. Chairman.
Is it close to that?
Chairman, not even close.
Representative Garofalo? No, that's what the testimony is. Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I've actually had like a little pet project that I've been trying to figure out a way to like just use outdoor air to keep these indoor data centers cool, because they do use quite a bit of energy, you know, regulating them, keeping it at an appropriate temperature. But there also is issues with moisture content and the variability of outside, so you end up not. But I don't know why we're talking about this right now.
No, that was really interesting. It was actual testimony that they want a colder climate for these data centers because they generate so much heat. Now, in my mind, that just meant open the window. Now, that's not what they're doing.
No, they don't.
Chair Garofalo.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, they don't all. There's no windows in data centers, Mr. Chairman. They don't. These are big like warehouses that are very nondescript and boring. But if I could, just getting back to the issue of the technical side of it.
Oh, we can do that, yeah.
Yeah.
Chair Garofalo.
I'm having a difficulty understanding the differentiation of qualified expenses for the sales tax exemption for software about when it is supposed to apply and when it is not supposed to apply. The definitions that the department went through, a lot of times these data centers are disaster recovery centers, or they are active situations where you have identical components at location A and component location B. And so while they're not actively being used, in the event of a failover scenario, they're activated. And I'm having a challenging time understanding how the current definition, specifically around software, not around hardware, is being interpreted and how it's supposed to be interpreted. I can just follow up with the department afterwards on that.
Well, Ms. Dalton, that is a pretty important question. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, I think part of the problem was the definition of computer software that was put in 2013, I believe, was illustrative as opposed to exhaustive. And so I think that's why we're having these issues. And I do think there needs to be some clarity one way or the other.
Chair Garofalo.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, this is just my opinion, and I certainly can change it if given new information. But I think also that those who are in the business of selling these products have saw this loophole and are directing a more open interpretation than perhaps we might have intended. That's just my opinion, but a lot of times you have flexibility about where you can license or locate the software. So software that may have been originally designed to be in data center A can now be interpreted to be installed and purchased for data center B. And so it's providing an incentive to purchase software and to domicile it in a new data center. But it's complicated stuff, and I don't pretend to have the answer, so let's go back to
I make it very simple. Just open the window.
Yeah, it's
That's going to be part of what we're going to have to figure out here as a committee. So with that, any other questions for Ms. Larson? We'll now go to Mr. Carlson. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the community of Minnesota Resorts. And by coincidence, not by planning, by coincidence, it is the Resorters Day on the Hill today. And so you may be seeing them in the hallway and visiting you. Now, Mr. Chairman, when I went over this bill with them last night, they wanted to know who authored this bill. But I didn't send them to your office because I knew that...
we'll be Representative Marquardt.
But we have serious problems with Article 4, Section 10 on page 22 of the bill. And you need to understand, or I want you to remember the great work that this committee has done over the past decade to try and make resort property taxes reasonable and in a structure that will allow resorts to remain viable. And the reason that you've taken all those steps is because when I started doing this work for them about 20 years ago, we had about 1,200 resorts then. We're a little over 800 now, and they continue to decline. But and property taxes are one of their largest, if not the largest, operating expense that they have. And so we've tried to make this tax structure something that they can live with and remain viable businesses, which are so important to tourism and your local economies. And this change on this page really upsets the apple cart in a number of arrangements that they have, because what the change says is that the same owner has to be living in the homestead as basically owns the property. And there are so many different ownership structures. In fact, the code provides for that through LLCs and partnerships and individual ownership. You have families who are trying to finance a house on the property while the LLC owns the resort. It's the use. It's all used as resort property, and that's what really we need to maintain, because there are so many different types of ownership structures saying that you're going to get kicked out of the residential homestead property tax classification, which we desperately need. If you change the ownership of one parcel where the homestead is a very difficult tool for us, and we would appreciate that proposal not moving forward, Mr. Chair. And we're happy to answer questions. I think Mr. McElroy and I are united completely on this one being a tough change for resorts.
You know, I have to apologize to members. I swore an oath that I would never carry another bill that had anything to do with vaping. And there you go. Okay, questions for Mr. Carlson on Article 4, Section 10 and the concerns he has. Any questions? So these are going to work through. As Mr. Cummings said, this is a work in progress, and we didn't say it like that, but we're going to work on these things.
Mr. Cummings did come and meet with the resorters yesterday, and just on a show of hands, how many have different ownership? I think he was surprised at the number of hands that went up. It doesn't impact a lot of the family-owned resorts in Minnesota. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. If there are no more questions for Mr. Carlson, we'll go to Mr. McElroy. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Resort and Campground Association. We represent similar members to those that Joel represents. I do have a letter that was sent to you, and I have copies of the page. Could distribute them to the members, please.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, we do not agree with the department that their proposal reflects current law. We think that the current law is very clear that there should be flexibility as to the ownership entity between the homestead and the balance of the resort. Many banks now prefer to put a conventional mortgage on the homestead and a business loan on the balance of the resort. You entertained a bill last year, House File 1830, authored by Representative Matt Bliss from Pennington, Minnesota, who is a resort owner, that had three provisions, one about resorts on leased land, one about resorts on state trails, and a third that would clarify this issue and make clear that a business could qualify for 1C treatment whether or not the resort and homestead were titled the same, if they were in effectively the same ownership. Two of those provisions in 1830 were in your omnibus bill and became law. This provision started in the omnibus bill, and at the request of the department it was removed, but it was clearly the will of the committee to provide that needed flexibility. So we, Joel and I, will meet with the department, but we would appreciate not having Section 10 of Article 4 included in an omnibus bill. Joel goes back to 1,200 resorts. There's a report from the Minnesota Extension Service going back to the 70s that at one point we had 3,400 resorts in Minnesota and have declined now to about 800. And there are how many Minnesotans access our 10,000 lakes and rivers. And it's important that we preserve them, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. McElroy. Questions for Mr. McElroy? Okay. With that, comments from members on this bill? Before we move the bill, I would like to announce that the governor's – oh, Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know our time is tight, but I just wanted to comment on the miscellaneous provision. I wanted to thank the department for updating the terminology for the disability community to reflect a more appropriate usage of the word disability, changing, for example, from disabled veteran to veteran with a disability. I think the disability community will also really appreciate that change. And with that, I was curious on the other change in the miscellaneous provision, changing in several places husband and wife to spouses and so on. And I'm understanding that to also be a terminology update, but I was just wondering if the department could provide some clarification on the reasoning behind that change.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, this is the changes that are in Article 5, Sections 6 through 9, 11, 14 through 17, and 27 to 28 is using language that we're trying to make statutes. It's a technical correction. We're trying to make statutes ensure that it is clear for all taxpayers who have to have filing or remittance or other types of requirements under the law that these laws do apply to them. There was the law change that happened in 2014, I believe it was. So this is just ensuring that people are clear about their filing obligations under the law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings. So has there been confusion and people are not filing their taxes properly because of the gender-specific terms that we currently have?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wills, we have not had a dispute at this time, and we believe that the law change from, I believe, 2014 was clear about this, but we always want to ensure that our statutes are consistent with people's current filing obligations.
Representative Wills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings. When you refer to the law that was changed in 2014, which law are you referring to?
This is the marriage bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify because that's what I thought you meant, but
yep,
I wasn't
that's right.
clear. And just more of a broader question, I guess. Are we looking at doing this in other areas of law as well beyond just in this in our tax provisions? I don't know if it's a question for you or for us just to be thinking about if we're going to be consistent throughout our statutes.
Mr. Chair, I know that there have been some that have been trying to ensure that our statutes are updated to have language that reflects sort of person-centered language or language that actually reflects the situation that's going on. I know this happened within our tax statutes for these two areas. I would also note that at one time, referring to a person in statute was referring to him, you know, or his. And so I think, you know, many years ago, many of those references were updated to ensure that it was more based on the individual rather than a gendered pronoun. This is obviously not what we're talking about today, right? We're talking about something else. But these are technical changes. No one will have a different filing obligation under the law. We're just trying to ensure that the language is updated to match what is currently applicable under the law.
Representative Wells?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Cummings. I just was curious about that, and I appreciate the clarification.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Wells. Okay, the governor's proposal comes out tomorrow. Mr. Cummings, do you know what time that is?
Mr. Chair, I don't think a time has been set for the governor's release.
Okay, we'll be watching with great anticipation, and I will be carrying that bill, and I'll ask Chair Marquardt to be on that bill also, if he'd be so kind. And any other members of the Tax Committee certainly are welcome to get on that bill. So that's tomorrow. I'd like to thank Attorney Iden, Reisdorf, Peterson, and Griffin for your testimony today before the committee. I think this is probably a good breaking time. I will move that House File 3410 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So we will do that. And then I am going to have, we'll probably start out tomorrow with 3329, 3566, and 2716, or should we, Eva, to pick this up first? Yeah, I guess what we'll do is we'll pick up 3411, and then we'll go with the agenda you have on the back of your sheet. And always, Mr. Cummings, thank you. Very well prepared. Really appreciated your testimony. So with that, anything else for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair?
Chair Erickson.
Just as a chair, keep in mind that you're the courtesy author of these provisions. That's how I label it. When I carry it for the Commissioner of Ed, I'm the courtesy author until it's really my bill.
Yes, and members, if you could please keep 3411 in your packet, and just so that the folks who put this together will have that should be ready to go. With that, members, thank you for your work today. Good government.